remanded in custody. The department put the total number of what it says are human rights violations at 162. Several suffered beatings and torture by the police and security details. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.
We can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. My opening serve is U.S. Open Tennis. Defending champions and top-ranked Novak Djokovic of Serbia and Naomi Osaka of Japan are the number one seeds at the U.S. Open, which begins Monday in New York. Osaka's first major title at last year's U.S. Open was overshadowed by a fiery on-court dispute involving Serena Williams and Portuguese chair umpire Carlos Ramos. Despite the drama, Osaka kept her cool and defeated Serena 6-2 and 6-4. Since then, Naomi Osaka went on to win the next major, the 2019 Australian Open, while Serena continues to try to equal Margaret Court's record of 24 Grand Slam singles titles. Now, there are question marks about the fitness of 37-year-old Serena Williams ahead of the U.S. Open. She's been bothered recently by back spasms that caused her to retire from the Canadian Open final and pull out of the Cincinnati Masters tournament. Serena is seeded eighth at the U.S. Open. 2019 French Open champion Ashley Barty of Australia is seeded second among the women, while Karolina Pliskova of the Czech Republic is seeded third. On the men's side in New York, Novak Djokovic got the top seed, followed by former U.S. Open champions Rafael Nadal of Spain and Roger Federer of Switzerland. Rafa has won the U.S. Open three times, in 2010, 2013, and 2017. Meanwhile, five of Roger Federer's record 20 Grand Slam singles titles have come in New York. And let's not forget defending champion Novak Djokovic. He has 16 Grand Slam singles titles, including three U.S. Open trophies. The highest-seeded African player in New York is the tall South African Kevin Anderson, who lost to Rafael Nadal in the 2017 U.S. Open final. Anderson is seeded 16th overall.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In basketball, the recent AfroBasket Continental Championship Tournament in Senegal showed how the women's game is growing in Africa. A capacity crowd of 15,000 attended the final between Nigeria and host Senegal at the Dakar Arena. It's reportedly the largest attendance for a basketball game ever in Africa. The Tigress of Nigeria defeated the Senegalese women 60-55 for their second consecutive African title and fourth overall. Joe Lopez is the director of Seed Academy in Senegal. Ricky Shryock asked him about the rising popularity of basketball among women.
Girls basketball has really grown on this continent. You see Nigeria played really well at the Africa Championship at the AfroBasket, but you also saw them when they played at the World Cup where they won two games. That was the first ever that an African team had won at that level. Of course, most of the players that play for Nigeria and some who play for Senegal do play and train in the United States and in Europe. Hence, their performance is always enhanced because the level of competition in those countries is much higher.
In places like the U.S. and Europe, where women or girls get to develop their basketball talent is through public schools. Do you guys have an idea of how that would happen in a different way than it happens in the U.S.? I doubt you could use the same approach that the U.S. has.
You hit it spot on. Right, we cannot probably emulate what the U.S. has done, but we can take lessons. We can learn from it. You cannot develop any kind of sport, not just basketball, without having an intercollegiate aspect of the sports. I learned to play basketball in Senegal back in the 60s and 70s, and we had intercollegiate team. You know, I had a high school team that I played for, you know, and I competed against all the high school. We need to really think about restarting the intercollegiate, or maybe rather the inter-high school competition, to just give girls and young boys an opportunity to compete. We used to have that. We used to have that in Senegal. And we need to go back into the archives and, you know, start doing it again.
In Senegal, at least, when you talk about boys and men, you've got football, you've got wrestling. Those are the big sports. And then basketball's trying to compete with those other sports. With girls, you don't see them. They don't do wrestling as much. And then there's not as much in terms of soccer or football as well. So do you think basketball is uniquely poised with girls and women to become a popular sport?
You are really hitting spot on what seems to be the issue here, right? Girls basketball does not, I mean, in Senegal, does not compete with any other sports. I mean, in the U.S., the women's soccer program is huge. Here, we don't have that issue. So basketball, like you said, is poised to really become a women's sport on this continent. And I keep talking about SEED because that's what I know and that's what I run here. We at SEED have begun to put a lot of emphasis on the girls' program.
That's Joe Lopez, the director of SEED Academy in Senegal. And Joe spoke with Ricky Shryock from Dakar. Elsewhere, Nigeria's national men's team, nicknamed the Tigers, has traveled to China for the FIBA Basketball World Cup, which tips off August 31st. Before the Tigers departed, Iron Mike Mbonye had a chance to chat with one of the Nigerian players, San Antonio Spurs forward Chimezie Metsu.
It's my first time playing with the team, so I'm looking forward to it. It feels great, you know. I've been waiting to do it for a long time, so I'm just happy I can be able to represent at the World Cup.
How would you rate your preparations for this World Cup?
I haven't been here for the last couple of windows, and everybody's been saying this is the best training camp that we've had. So, I mean, for me, it's been great. Just coming out here, competing with everybody, and just looking forward to getting out there.
What's the experience been like being drafted into the NBA and playing with the big players?
It's been great, you know, just being able to learn from all the guys, you know, DeMar, LaMarcus, Patty, all those guys. It's been great, you know, learning under the Spurs system, Pop and everybody. I'm just looking forward to keep getting better.
What was the relationship with Ime Udoka, a former captain of Nigeria's men's basketball team? Did you guys talk about Nigeria?
Yeah, of course. We talked a lot about Nigerian basketball. He told me about his experiences with the team and everything, and I kind of told him he was the one that really helped me move forward with playing with the team. You know, I just told him I've been trying to do it since I was in high school, and he finally just, you know, he called Musa. I had a meeting with Musa, and I met with him, and next thing you know, I'm here with the team. So I'm really grateful for him. And even though it was just 1 year, it was still very helpful.
That's San Antonio Spurs forward Chimezie Metsu, a member of Nigeria's national men's basketball team, and he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye in Lagos.
Hi, my name is Chimezie Metsu of San Antonio Spurs. I want to do a special shout out to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Encourage our VOA listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see an action-packed photo by Action Images photographer Jason Carnduff. Jason was trackside at the recent Muller Grand Prix meet in Birmingham, England, and he took a nice shot of a soaring Naffy Teum in the women's long jump. The Olympic and World Heptathlon champion from Belgium is shown wearing different color Nike track spikes, one white and one black. And I asked the energetic Andy Edwards about that. Energetic Andy says he's seeing more and more athletes on the circuit going with the different color footwear. Perhaps more eye-catching in Jason's photo, though, is Naffy Teum's long braided hair, which seems to be soaring even higher than her. Meanwhile, the energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Kendra Kenny Harrison, the American world record holder in the women's 100-meter hurdles at that Birmingham meet. Here's Andy.
Kenny Harrison is the world record holder in the women's sprint hurdles, and she's been talking about how in her collegiate career, well, she was running the 400 hurdles as well. And, well, I'm not sure whether she was holding out tantalizing prospects of maybe one day coming back to the one-lap hurdles. But, Kenny, how was there a moment when you felt, well, right, I've got to concentrate on the 100-meter hurdles instead of the one-lap?
I think 2015, when I graduated, it was like going into USA's, I was ranked number two in the world in the 100 and 400 hurdles. And my coach said, it's up to you. You can choose which event you want to do. And I just loved the 100 hurdles more. I mean, the 400 hurdles, it hurts. So I was just like, I'm going to try the 100 hurdles. And so that's how I chose that event. It just, I like it better.
And of course, you've been very successful, world record in London 3 years ago. It may sound strange to say, well, if you're a world record holder, has that been a burden? But sometimes, does it feel that, oh, I'm always trying to get close or get under that time?
Right now, I'm not really thinking too much about the world record. I think during 2016, it was like, okay, you didn't make the Olympic team, so now what can you do to lift yourself up, lift your spirits up, and, you know, the world record was next. So that's why it was so important that that I did that for myself. But now it's just, I want to go and get medals. That's the main thing. You know, everyone says, like, the records are the hardest to get. So now the medals are next. And, you know, once I'm able to, you know, do what I think I can, I think that's when it's like, okay, now you can try another event. But
in the Muller Grand Prix, the latest round of the Diamond League in Birmingham in England, you've got the heats of the sprint hurdles and then a final. And it sounds from you talking that you kind of like that in a one-day meeting, but you mm-hmm. like it. It's almost replicating a championship.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it's just like the first round. You can just kind of go out there and get your nerves out and fix things that, you know, maybe a little rusty. Like, say my trail leg was like a little bit behind, and it's like, all right, finals, I need to pull my trail leg, you know, it's stuff like that. So I think everyone always does well with rounds. So I'm looking forward to that.
Just one more thing, coming back to that world record in London. Do you look at video of that? I mean, you talk about sort of, oh, my trail leg and everything, or do you just say, well, look, that was 3 years ago, and let's look at more recent stuff?
I don't really watch it a lot, but my coach always references back to it during practice sometimes, like, okay, well, like, the last three hurdles you floated, so, like, we need to work on that, or, you know, your start, you didn't get out as hard as you possibly could, so we need to work on that. So it's just taking bits and pieces and just trying to fix where I may, like, lack.
Well, Kenny, there may be bits and pieces to fix, but there haven't been that many so far in recent years. The world record holder, Kenny Harrison, in the sprint hurdles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, energetic Andy Edwards, for that interview with Kendra Kenny Harrison of the USA, the world record holder in the women's 100-meter hurdles.
I'm Kendra Harrison. I'm the 100-hurdle world record holder for Team USA, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Joining us now with more tennis news, as well as some golf stories, is my VOA colleague, Jim Stevenson.
Yeah, it's been the best weeks in my life.
Russian Daniil Medvedev didn't have the celebration he thought upon winning his first Masters 1000 title at the Cincinnati Masters Tennis Tournament.
If you would have asked me before the tournament, how would I celebrate? I would probably say, yeah, I'm going to fall on the court. I'm going to start screaming, then jumping and raising my hand up. And I was so exhausted.
Medvedev struggled to finish the final against David Goffin of Belgium 7-6, 6-4.
I started cramping everywhere. Of course, I tried to not show it. And this last game, 15-40, I cramp everywhere. I say, okay, 55-all, what do I do? And I make four amazing serves, and when I make the last one, I'm like, wow, it's finished, I won it. And I had no zero force inside of me to do anything.
Goffin wasn't aware Medvedev struggled.
He started to cramp?
Yeah.
Didn't notice.
All Goffin saw was a tough opponent.
He's super solid. He doesn't miss. It's like playing against the wall. His pace is not too fast, not too slow. It's quite a special pace, you know, to play against him. It's not easy to play.
Medvedev found new strength in part of his game.
It's my serve that's not usually my biggest weapon, and that's been working amazing these 3 weeks, all the tournaments, all three tournaments, and that's a great step ahead that I was working a lot. I would say mostly not before American seasons, but in the preseason that starts working better and better.
Goffin had a strategy.
The tactic was not to play always the same pace, you know, to give him a different kind of ball to, because he's a machine, left, right, left, right. It's not a problem. You have to change, play short, try to slice, try to attack, try to go to the net to change, and that's what I did. It worked, but it was not enough.
At age 23, Medvedev is the youngest Cincinnati champion since Andy Murray of Britain at age 21 in 2008. He had lost in finals in his previous two tournaments. The third time proved to be the charm.
If I would have lost three finals in a row, I would have not doubted myself, but like started asking myself, how is it possible? Three finals, lost three all of them. What should I do different in the final? And finally, I don't have to ask myself these questions because, well, I won the final.
It turns out Medvedev has a secret weapon in, or should we say, on his hands.
It's just one gel to not have sweaty hands because it's so humid in USA. And funny thing, I started using it last year in Winston-Salem, and after this, my results were only going up. So now, even when it's not humid, I put just a little bit because it helps me so much, because otherwise I just cannot hold the racket. It just slips out of my hand.
With the U.S. Open in front of him, Medvedev has goals.
To reach my first quarterfinal will be good, and I take it match by match. If I will be in quarterfinal, I will try to do my best to win everything, but at this moment, I need to take it step by step and just become a better player every day.
But first, a celebration for his Cincinnati win.
In Russia, we say, who doesn't risk doesn't drink champagne. So I'm drinking champagne tonight.
It's obviously, you know, the biggest title I've ever won.
American Madison Keys was the other surprise winner in Cincinnati.
I played some really, really great players from round one until today. So I definitely think I played some of my best tennis consistently this week.
Keys defeated Russian Svetlana Kuznetsova 7-5, 7-6.
I think I just really focused in on obviously really important games and was able to make her play a lot of balls, and luckily figured out a way to level up the scoreline.
Kuznetsova felt she had opportunities.
I had all the chances. Sometimes it goes this way, you know, the game is like this. It was very even match, you know, it could go either way.
Key says she found just the right strategy.
I think I served really well today, especially in certain pockets. And I think when I was doing a good job at moving forward and kind of trying to neutralize some of her deep, heavy, spinny shots, I was able to get out in front and the point and play a little bit more offense.
At 34, Kuznetsova was the oldest finalist in Cincinnati tournament history. She got a late start this season as she completed a seven-month recovery from a knee injury. The loss was a victory in terms of her positive outlook.
I feel great. You know, each match which I played, the free setter could go either way. And I'm happy I won most of them. The last one, okay, I was one step shorter, but maybe it's better this way, you know, as I'm trying to see positive in everything. It's more motivation for me for the future.
The 24-year-old Keys moves up to number 10 in the women's rankings and is feeling pretty good heading to the U.S. Open.
I want to do well in New York, and I want to have a good end of the season, so taking a lot of positives from this week, but just trying to reel it in a little bit.
As for the tall winner's trophy presented to her,
my grandma said that she wanted it for a vase so she could put flowers in it, but we'll see. I'll probably keep this one.
Golfer Thomas Peters of Belgium had already won a Czech Masters title. He picked up another in his latest visit to Prague.
I think the key was the driving. I hit it really far and really straight, so that gave me a lot of birdie opportunities and a lot of short clubs into the hole, so and to convert the putt.
And he finished strong.
It's nice to, you know, stay patient again and have something like on 18, a nice birdie to finish.
Spaniard Adriano finished one shot behind.
I never gave up. I trying to, you know, make some birdies coming in and see if he made a mistake, which he didn't.
Playing alongside Peters, it was a two-man race to the title.
It came to my mind like it was sort of like a match play, so I just tried to, you know, beat him in two holes, which I did, but came one short.
Your home event for any player is always very special. It might not be a very big event on the schedule, but for the home players, it's always their kind of their major behind the majors. So it's always great to play at home.
Robert Karlsson is one of several Swedish golfers in Gothenburg for the Scandinavian Open, where he'll see many friendly faces.
It's really good crowds both in Sweden and in Denmark, and they do give their home players good support.
Marcus Kinnelt might feel a bit rusty.
I've had a break now for 5 weeks, so we'll see. I've done some practice and I've played at home at my home club, but I haven't played any tournament golf in 5 weeks.
But being on home soil among friends will help.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of guests, first of all, and I know there will be some familiar faces in the crowds. So that's always nice. It only happens once every year, so it's very special.
Fellow Swede Henrik Stenson returns to the event after an absence.
I didn't manage to play this event last year, so we're here this year and looking forward to the week. It's a lot of familiar faces, obviously. It feels like a little bit of a class reunion when you're coming back home.
The course holds special memories for him.
I think it was actually my first European Tour event ever. I played here in outskirts of Gothenburg in 1996, so fun to be back home and playing in front of the Swedish crowds.
While winning in his native Sweden would be great, Stenson says he and the rest of the players will first have to navigate some interesting terrain.
Well, the name is Hills, and it's certainly got a few hills. It's a tough walk. A lot of tee boxes are on elevated positions around the golf course. The wind is certainly one thing that makes it extremely tough at times. It's swirling a lot, and it's one of them. It's going to put a lot of uncertainty into your mind and some really challenging golf shots out there, and with those components, it's a tough test.
Swedish golfer Henrik Stenson. And who knows? Maybe we'll see Henrik at next year's Tokyo Olympics. The 43-year-old Swede won a silver medal at the 2016 Olympics in Brazil, where he finished two strokes behind gold medalist Justin Rose of England. And thanks to my VOA colleague Jim Stevenson for that spicy golf and tennis package. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Are you having trouble getting tickets for next year's Tokyo Olympics? Well, that's no problem if you live in Japan and have $60,000 to spare. That's right. Tokyo Olympic organizers are offering high-end hospitality packages to Japan residents, with prices soaring to 6.35 million yen, about $60,000. This is good for the opening and closing ceremony. 9 days of track and field with luxury seating and sumptuous dining. Tokyo is shaping up as a very, very pricey Olympics. And that wraps up the August 22nd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Sidrak Franklin. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the continent has seen a decline in the number of authoritarian regimes since the 80s, but still, the number of democracies has not increased significantly. A report card on democracy on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the recently released Global Climate Report from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, July 2019 was the hottest month ever recorded in the NOAA Global Temperature Dataset record, which dates back to 1880. The report from scientists at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information also indicates that the sweltering July heat shrank both Arctic and Antarctic sea ice to historic lows. The average global temperature in July, according to the report, was 0.95 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average of 15.77 degrees Celsius. The previous hottest month on record was July 2016. According to the report, record warm July temperatures were measured across parts of North America, Southern Asia, Southern Africa, the Northern Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and across the western and northern parts of the Pacific Ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt. Hooray! If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show.
I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, yeah.
Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
Voice of
of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts covering Africa and the world news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd. French President Emmanuel Macron warned British Prime Minister Boris Johnson Thursday that any revised Brexit pact cannot stay far away from the accord already rejected by the British Parliament. A key sticking point has been the border between EU member Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is part of Britain. Known as the Irish backstop, Macron said it was indispensable to preserving stability and the EU market. Johnson said that Britain has to leave the EU whether or not there is a new deal.
I was powerfully encouraged by our conversations last night in Berlin with our mutual friends, and I know that with energy and with creativity and application, we can find a way forward for all our businesses and our citizens.
EU members maintain that any deal must allow for passage across the border for residents who live in the region without stopping for passport checks, as well as cross-border trade. The United States and the Afghan Taliban have resumed peace talks in Qatar to try to conclude an agreement that would bring an end to the longest U.S. overseas military intervention. The ninth round of talks got underway Thursday afternoon in Doha amid expectations it would lead to the much-awaited peace agreement between the two adversaries. The talks came a day after clashes with Taliban insurgents in northern Afghanistan killed two American soldiers, bringing the total number of U.S. fatalities in the country this year to 14. A deal, if reached, would require Washington to announce a timeline for withdrawing U.S.-led foreign troops from the country. In return, the Taliban would give guarantees they would not allow transnational terrorists to use Afghan soil for attacks on other countries. This is VOA News. Iran displayed what it described as a domestically built long-range mobile surface-to-air missile system on Thursday. Reuters correspondent Megan Revelle reports.
State TV released footage on Thursday showing President Hassan Rouhani at the unveiling ceremony for the Bavar 373 system. The announcement comes amid rising tension with the United States. Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone in the Gulf with a surface-to-air missile in June, saying it was over its territory. But the U.S. insists the drone was in international airspace. Iran has developed a large domestic arms industry in the face of international sanctions and embargoes. Western analysts say Iran often exaggerates its weapon capabilities, but there are still strong concerns about its long-range ballistic missile program.
Megan Revelle of Reuters. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has assured Canada that the United States is working to get China to release two Canadians it detained last year on espionage charges. The cases were linked to U.S. charges against the chief financial officer of the Chinese tech company Huawei. Pompeo said the United States is doing all it can to get the two Canadians released.
Please do know that our team is focused on helping those two Canadians be released. China needs to honor the commitments it's made to the world, and it's our expectation they'll do so, and we're working on it diligently. It's wrong that they're being held.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he appreciated U.S. efforts and would be talking with Pompeo about how we move forward on that. China detained former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig and entrepreneur Michael Spavor in December of 2018 in an apparent attempt to pressure Canada to release Meng Wanzhou. Meng, the CFO of Huawei, was arrested in December in Vancouver at the request of U.S. authorities who want her to stand trial on fraud charges in the United States. President Trump is getting some support for his handling of the economy in a new poll, but his overall numbers remain weak. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
The AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll finds 62% of Americans disapprove, while 36% approve. The numbers have been remarkably consistent since he took office.
Can you believe it's almost 3 years now?
And his approval ratings have never gone below 32% or above 42% in the AP NORC polls. By comparison, Barack Obama's Gallup poll approval never dipped below 40%. The new poll shows 46% approval for President Trump's handling of the economy, but at least 60% disapproval on issues like guns and immigration.
AP's Sagar Meghani. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Thursday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, reactions continue to emerge from U.S. President Donald Trump's remark last week about Israel.
In my opinion, you vote for a Democrat, you're being very disloyal to Jewish people, and you're being very disloyal to Israel.
But what are the political implications? Also, South Korea and Japan have scrapped a key military agreement, and the WHO releases a new report on microplastic in water. All these stories and more are next. U.S. President Donald Trump has made a lot of headlines this week. He's canceled a planned trip to Denmark because the country's prime minister made a nasty remark in reaction to his suggestion regarding Greenland. He also said American Jews who vote for Democrats show either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty. The president has also announced he's looking to end birthright citizenship, which is enshrined in the Constitution's 14th Amendment. Now, to help unpack the political implications of these statements and more, we're joined at the line by Dr. Richard Himmelfarb, professor of political science at Hofstra University. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess where I want to begin is exactly how do we begin by looking at the political implications of everything that's coming out of the White House this week?
Well, it's a... You know, in my assessment, just more of the same. President says something. It sets off this whirlwind of controversy and discussion and pushback, and then defense by him and people loyal to him. And then the dust settles, and we move on to the next controversy. So one thing I can say with certainty is that by next week at this time, we will barely remember this because there will have been three or four controversies that will have popped up, you know, in between the ones we're discussing now and next week.
So speaking of controversies, Mr. Trump is headed to the G7 coming up this weekend. How does this kind of international focus on what he's saying regarding Denmark, regarding Israel, play into any kind of conversations he may have with other world leaders while meeting with the G7 group?
You know, I don't know that it's going to have much effect. I tend to believe that these leaders look at the United States and they see us as the great superpower of the world. And regardless of what Trump says or what types of insults he levies against countries or people, these leaders are, for the most part, I think, disciplined enough and sort of mature enough to understand that life goes on even with somebody as sort of volatile and unpredictable as Donald Trump.
Well, these are international questions, but of course, here in the United States, we are in the 2020 presidential election cycle. A lot of the remarks over time that the president has made seem to be geared towards energizing his base. Is this more of the same?
Are you referring to the remarks he made about Jewish people?
Jewish people, as well as the comments about ending birthright citizenship and immigration policies coming out this week.
Well, I think that what you're going to see, you know, beginning maybe a few months ago and going forward, is practically everything that he sends or tweets out is going to be done with an eye towards the 2020 election and energizing the base. I mean, that's how elections work in this country today. Both sides try to energize the base. There aren't that many people who are in the middle, who are really undecided and who could vote for either party. And so elections are won or lost by energizing the people who are your supporters and getting them angry enough and excited enough to go out and vote.
Dr. Richard Himmelfarb is a political science professor at Hofstra University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A North Korean spokesman said on Thursday the United States' recent testing of mid-range cruise missiles, along with plans to deploy fighter jets and military equipment around the Korean Peninsula, would trigger a new Cold War in the region. On the government website, the spokesman said that North Korea remains unchanged in its position to resolve all issues through dialogue and negotiation, but dialogue accompanied by military threats is of no use to it. North's stance comes the day after the U.S. envoy to North Korea, Stephen Biegun, said the Trump administration was ready to resume working-level talks on nuclear negotiations following the second summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. In addition, today, South Korea announced it will end an intelligence-sharing pact with Japan, a decision that could further escalate a dispute over history and trade and undercut security cooperation with North Korea. To get a broader picture of the events, I spoke earlier with Mintaro Oba, a U.S. State Department official under the Obama administration. I began our conversation by asking him what he thought the prospects of talks were between the United States and North Korea.
Well, we're at a pivotal moment in U.S.-North Korea diplomacy between a moment of tension caused by the diplomatic impasse we've had so far and U.S.-ROK combined military exercises, and a moment of opportunity created by those exercises ending and the time pressure to get some sort of agreement by the end of the year. So I do see some prospect for diplomacy between the United States and North Korea moving forward in the coming months. But at the same time, I'd caution that the really fundamental issues that brought the two countries to an impasse, such as defining denuclearization or the extent of sanctions relief, have really not been resolved yet.
You mentioned that there is an opportunity. What makes this opportunity different than, say, the last few years of trying to get North Korea to the table to commit to denuclearization, even though that is a term that both sides really haven't agreed to in what it means yet?
Well, I am not sure that this opportunity is different. I have previously characterized the state of U.S.-North Korea relations under the Trump administration as defibrillator diplomacy, in that the process comes close to death at various points throughout the year, and the United States jump-starts it again with a big shock of energy through summit diplomacy, but it hasn't treated the underlying diseases that cause the process to come to the brink of failure again and again. So I would have a lot of concern that the United States remains not flexible enough and not creative enough to really make the most out of any opportunity with North Korea.
If we step back and look at a more regional aspect of it, Seoul has announced that it is going to end the intelligence sharing agreement it has with Tokyo. What do you see as the implications of that agreement coming to an end?
Well, first of all, there are the practical implications that South Korea and Japan will no longer be able to share critical intelligence regarding North Korean missiles and other key security considerations directly. But more broadly, it sets an extremely dangerous precedent because previously, for many years, Korea and Japan hands could count on the fact that the security relationship between the two countries would be shielded from bilateral political tensions and treated more pragmatically than other areas of the relationship. And this marks a real turning point, and it sets a precedent that, you know, security cooperation can be held hostage to broader tensions.
Hasn't that always been the case between Seoul and Tokyo? If we take a look at this agreement that is coming to an end, it was going to go into place several years ago during the Imanbak administration. But when he visited Dokdo, which is a disputed territory that Japan also claims as Takashima, that deal was scrapped. So is the politicalization of these type of agreement anything new?
Well, that's a great point. I think this particular agreement has been so high profile that it has always contained some sort of political elements. But the United States has worked hard to make trilateral security cooperation very pragmatic. Scrapping this JSOMIA agreement now really hampers the progress that we have made in the last few years.
Mintaro Oba is a former U.S. State Department official under the Obama administration joining us on the phone today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
France joined Germany on Thursday in challenging British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to show he can come up with a better alternative to the main sticking point in the stalled Brexit negotiations, giving him a month to prove that he can break the deadlock on the Irish border question.
It is vital for trust in politics that if you have a referendum, then you should act on the instructions of the voters. And that is why we must come out of the EU on October the 31st, deal or no deal.
Johnson tried to exude confidence and charm in Paris as he pressed French President Emmanuel Macron to accept his request to reopen Brexit negotiations. Macron reiterated that the EU has been, what the EU has been saying for months, that it won't reopen the Brexit divorce deal negotiated with Britain's previous Prime Minister, Theresa May. The sticky point remains the question of the Republic of Ireland and its border with Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom. Border checkpoints there were a flashpoint for sectarian violence in the past, and some fear their reintroduction could damage the hard-won peace in Northern Ireland. Among other top stories in the world, the death toll from a suicide bomb attack at a wedding at an Afghan capital last week has risen to 80. Survivors said hundreds of guests were inside the hall when the blast occurred near the stage where the musicians were playing. A fresh push to repatriate Rohingya refugees to Myanmar appeared Thursday to fall flat with no one turning up to get on 5 buses and 10 trucks arranged by Bangladesh. Australia is seeing an increase in interest in its millionaire-only visa program for wealthy Hong Kong residents who are eyeing a safety net amid political turmoil in the Chinese-ruled territory. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our mobile app. This is VOA News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Iranian state media reported on Thursday that Tehran displayed what it described as a domestically built long-range mobile surface-to-air missile. Reuters reporter Megan Ravel has those details.
Iran has displayed what it describes as a domestically built long-range missile defense system. State TV released footage on Thursday showing President Hassan Rouhani at the unveiling ceremony for the Bavar 373 system. The announcement comes amid rising tension with the United States. Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone in the Gulf with a surface-to-air missile in June, saying it was over its territory. But the US insists the drone was in international airspace. Iran has developed a large domestic arms industry in the face of international sanctions and embargoes. Western analysts say Iran often exaggerates its weapon capabilities, but there are still strong concerns about its long-range ballistic missile program.
And that was Reuters reporter Megan Ravel. Coal has powered progress since the Industrial Revolution. While coal-fired power is on the rise in Asia, it's declining in the United States and much of Europe as cheaper alternatives and climate concerns push it out of the market. While the fall in coal demand has hit mining towns hard in the Appalachian regions of the eastern United States, the western state of Wyoming is the nation's leading coal producer. VOA Steve Barragona reports that now coal's troubles have arrived in this energy-rich state as well.
The colossal mines of Wyoming's Powder River Basin ship some of the cheapest coal in the country to power plants from Georgia to Oregon. As coal-fired power has lost ground to natural gas and renewables, companies with mines here still felt secure, says University of Wyoming economist Robert Godby.
Those companies were seen to have jewels in their balance sheets because the Powder River Basin was so profitable. But that's changed in a few short years.
This year, two Wyoming coal companies went bankrupt.
The gates went down, they pulled everybody off. And that is a really sobering moment because it is the thing they said would never happen, and it happened.
Melissa Peterson-Worden worked for Black Jewel, the second of the two failed companies. Black Jewel's messy bankruptcy has disrupted her life and the lives of about 600 others.
Oh, we're struggling. We're struggling. We're holding on. Our big one is the house payment. Hi, girls.
Former Black Jewel miner Rory Wallet says until now, working in the mines has been a good job with good pay and benefits.
It's a wonderful way to make a living, a decent, livable living. I've got four kids, so it's a great way to keep them insured, keep food on the table, keep a good home over their head.
Coal has built the city as you see it, I feel, with the royalties and property tax and sales tax.
Louise Carter King is mayor of Gillette, Wyoming, home to two Black Jewel mines and several others. She says the city has to find new industries, and she has high hopes for the new integrated test center nearby. Next year, competitors from the Carbon XPRIZE will plug in to the coal-fired power plant's exhaust to find ways to capture and make products from the plant's carbon dioxide.
Even though there's just one winner for the $10 million prize, the other four won't be bad, you know, and so we're hoping some of the, you know, one of those industries or more could stay here.
Many scientists consider carbon capture essential to fighting climate change, but it's years off at best. In the meantime, Rory Wallet says recent events have shaken his faith in coal, but not by much.
I'd lie if I said it didn't. I plan on hanging on. If I don't get a coal job immediately, I'll keep looking in the basin. They're always available. It really is part of family and part of life. It's something I love doing.
But there's a growing sense in Gillette that coal will not be here forever.
That is the big question. What's next? And pardon the pun, Gillette needs to dig deep to figure out what next is. The United States is saying, what do you have for us now? And we have to come up with a better answer than, if you don't like coal, don't turn your lights on. We can't be those people anymore.
It's an uncertain future for a city and an industry in transition. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Gillette, Wyoming.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro said today that the government lacks the resources to fight wildfires in the Amazon rainforest after satellite images showed a record number of burning spots this year. In a speech broadcast live on Facebook, the president said the government is investigating the fires. He also said that he never claimed non-governmental organizations were starting fires in the forest, saying he was only talking of his suspicions. Brazil's National Institute for Space Research, which monitors deforestation and wildfires, said more than 74,000 wildfires have been detected so far this year in the Amazon rainforest, an 84% increase from the same period last year. You're listening to VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Microplastics contained in drinking water pose a low risk to human health at current levels, but more research is needed to reassure consumers, according to a new report by the World Health Organization. Reuters' Grace Lee has that story.
It's not visible to the naked eye, but this cup of water contains microplastics. You're potentially ingesting these microplastics every day, though, according to the World Health Organization, it's nothing to worry about yet.
Well, after having reviewed all the data, I think our message is one of reassurance to potentially worried consumers and that the health risks that were assessed to be low.
On Thursday, the organization released its first report on potential health risks associated with ingesting microplastics. There's limited data, they say, but so far, that data has been reassuring.
The main message is that the vast majority of microplastics would pass harmlessly through the body.
According to the environmental charity WWF International, plastic pollution has become so widespread in the environment that you could be ingesting 5 grams a week, the equivalent of eating a credit card. A large source of that comes from drinking water, but the WHO says there's a bigger problem when it comes to health threats in water.
Well, right now, there's 2 billion people in the world that are drinking fecally contaminated water, which is a staggering number, and there is almost 1 million deaths per year.
That can lead to diseases that cause diarrhea and even death, especially in poor countries lacking water treatment systems.
So that's really what people need to focus on, especially in Africa and South Asia and places where there's insufficient or inadequate water supply and sanitation.
And that was Reuters reporter Grace Lee. A 3-year study by 13 leading malaria and public health experts finds malaria eradication is feasible, but it will take new tools, political commitment, and lots of money to achieve it. Lisa Schlein has those details.
The concept of malaria eradication is not new. It has been around since the mid-1950s, when the World Health Organization launched its first global malaria eradication plan. Though that and subsequent efforts have failed to rid the world of the deadly, debilitating disease, experts say malaria eradication is feasible. They say there is no biological barrier to its elimination. The director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says achieving that goal would involve improving primary health care and access to services, and better use of data and surveillance systems. But the key to eradicating malaria, he says, is accelerated research and development of new tools.
We need a re-energized research and development effort to develop the knowledge base, the strategies and the tools, be these vector control tools, drugs, improved vaccines, or other technologies that will allow us to walk the last mile or even accelerate our road to eradication.
Global malaria infection and death rates have remained virtually unchanged since 2015. The World Health Organization reports every year some 200 million people are infected with malaria and about 400,000 die. It says more than 90% of those deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Children are the biggest victims. Health experts say eradicating malaria would both save lives and boost economies, but that takes political commitment and money. The WHO estimates the cost of scaling up current malaria intervention until 2030 at $34 billion. The agency says the return on that investment would be huge. It says the strategy the money buys would save 4 million lives over the next 11 years and would prevent 2 billion people from being infected with malaria. The economic gain, it says, would be roughly $283 billion in total gross domestic product. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.